what they ate. There is no word in Keshe for famine. Hunting and gathering is supposed to be a mode of subsistence incompatible with farming. When people learn to herd and farm, they stop hunting and gathering as a rule. The Keshe disobeyed the rule. Their hunting was of very little real importance to their food supply. Most of it was done, and most game was eaten, by children. It may be asked how important hunting has ever been as a principal source of human food, except where there are no other sources of protein readily available. The intense symbolic value of hunting, especially to men, has disguised its practical triviality, so that man the hunter romantically dominates the scene, while the women who actually provide and prepare the food he lives on are not discussed. As to us, hunting, to the Keshe, was a mixture of sport, religion, self-discipline, and self-indulgence. Gathering, however, was a major source of food. They gathered wild produce, acorns, greens, roots, herbs, berries, and many kinds of seeds, some requiring great patience to collect and process, and did so not at whim, but methodically, going yearly in due season to the family's trees, the town's seed meadows or cattail beds. The question, why, might fairly, I think, be countered by the question, why not? The natural food supply was very rich, and they liked the taste and quality, and since large families, a large private food supply, and a competitive attitude were all socially disapproved, there was no need or motivation to give up gathering for heavy farming. The essential factor is probably population size and growth, whether considered as cause or as effect. The city, the opposite of the farm, does not occur unless or until the land is heavily used for farming. Population explosions of any species depend upon excess food. The furrow ends in the street. The Keshe lived half in town and half in the wilderness. They had no streets, and their farms were, by our standards, gardens. These were not particularly neat gardens, since a great many different people worked in them, with animal rather than machine assistants, or as assistants to animals rather than machines, and the patches and plots, except for the great vineyards of the valley floor, were small and various. Indeed, what they planted and prepared as food was various, surprisingly so for a people many of whose cultural styles were limited, resistant to borrowing, and pure. For example, corn, maize, was the nearest thing to a staple grain they had, but they also gathered acorns, raised wheat, barley, and oats, and traded for rice. Rice and barley were mostly hulled and boiled whole. The other grains were variously prepared as groats, meal or flour, and boiled, baked, leavened, baked unleavened, and so on, giving a great variety of grain dishes, porridges, and breads. In sum, the Keshe took or found or raised or grew food wherever convenient, and cooked and ate it with interest, respect, and pleasure. They were not a thin people. Small-boned, they tended towards the round rather than the angular, the easy rather than the lean. Food is not something that lends itself to discussion in the abstract. It seems more sensible to give some recipes. Bliriv metadi, or valley succotash. Wash about 2 cups of small red beans, the valley metadi is very like the Mexican frijoli, and cook till done, a couple of hours, with half an onion, 3 or 4 garlic cloves, and a bay leaf. Simmer about 1½ cups of parched corn until thoroughly cooked, and drain, or in season use fresh corn cut off the cob, uncooked. Simmer a handful of dried black mushrooms for 30 minutes or so, and keep them in their cooking broth. When all these ingredients are done, combine them, along with the juice and pulp of a lemon, or some preserved tamarind pulp, an onion chopped and fried in oil with some finely chopped garlic and a spoonful of cumin seeds, a large, mild green chili of the chili verde type, or a small hot green chili, but not bell pepper, seeded and chopped fine. 3 or 4 tomatoes, peeled and chopped coarsely. Add, as seasoning, oregano, winter savory, and more lemon to taste. Add dried red chili if you want it hot. To thicken the sauce, 1 dried tomato paste ball was added. Our equivalent would be 2 or 3 tablespoons of thick tomato paste. If fresh tomatoes are not in season, double or triple the quantity of tomato paste. All this simmers for about 1 hour. Serve with chopped raw onion to garnish, and a sour sauce or chutney made of green tomatoes or tomatillos, flavored with fresh or dry coriander leaf. This dish, too heavy for rice, was accompanied by cornbreads, either of the hoe cake or the tortilla type. Hotaka, old hen, a rice and chicken dinner. Simmer a big, old, tough chicken with bay leaf, rosemary, and some wine until done. Since most of us cannot get big, old, tough chickens, simmer a little young, tough one. Cool and take the meat off the bones. Save enough of the stock to cook the rice in. Cook the rest down if it is thin, and then simmer in it for 5 to 15 minutes until just barely done some or any of the following. A handful of blanched whole almonds, sliced celery, carrots, radishes, yellow or green squash, onions, etc. A few leaves of spinach, Chinese cabbage, or other greens, whole mushrooms, fresh or dried. Add the chicken meat cut up, some chopped parsley, chopped fresh coriander or dry coriander leaf, and chopped green onions. Season with cumin seed, coriander seed, a little ground red pepper, and salt or lemon. Let it sit all day or overnight for the flavors to get used to one another. Reheat gently and serve with rice cooked in the stock. Serve any or all of the following as accompaniments: chopped hard-boiled eggs, toasted tarweed or chia seeds, chopped coriander leaves, green onions, green tomato or tomatillo sauce or sour pickle, hot red pepper chutney or pickle, currant jelly, dried currants or chopped raisins. These would be arranged in little dishes around the main dish. Most of the rice that came to the valley was from the peoples of the River of the Marshes and was short-grained, cooking up rather sticky. They prized and would trade their best wines for the rarer, long-grained, very fine-flavored sasi rice grown farther south and east of the inland sea. Pragasiv Fas, summer soup. A hot-weather aftermath to a lamb feast. Cook up in a piece of butter about egg yolk size, about half that much cornstarch, corn flour, and one egg yolk, stirring gently to make a thickening paste or roux. Cool this and stir in about a cup of yogurt and about 2 cups of cold lamb broth, made from the bones, cleared of all fat. Flavor to taste with lemon juice and or dry white wine. Serve topped with chopped mint leaves. For a hot soup, add cooked barley while heating gently, and use parsley or chervil instead of mint. Dur mdrevi, red and green, a vegetable dinner. Peel one large or several small eggplants and slice about as thick as my finger is. Sprinkle the slices with lemon juice and coarse salt, and let them sit while you prepare the rest for cooking. Slice a couple of fair-sized zucchini squash, unpeeled, the same way, and also sprinkle with lemon juice. A handful of parsley, the stems cut off. A couple of garlic cloves, chopped fine. A double handful of mushrooms, any delicate kind, fresh. Make a sauce of 2 cloves of garlic thoroughly mashed in a mortar or press, about 2 tablespoons of good olive oil, and a dash of ground red pepper, all stirred into 2 cups of yogurt until smooth and creamy. Fry the zucchini fast and hot in light oil in an iron pan until the edges brown. Pile it on one end of a platter. Using less oil, fry the eggplant very fast and hot till it turns vivid red-brown. Pile it on the other end of the platter. Stir-fry the mushrooms, garlic, and parsley, gently and quickly, just till the parsley wilts, and pile it in the center of the platter. Serve at once along with potatoes boiled in their jackets. The yogurt sauce accompanies both the vegetables and the potatoes, poured over them or used as a dip. Sliced tomatoes and black olives go well with this dish. Huavuan, oak eggs. Acorn meal compares interestingly with corn meal and wheat flour. Before cooking, corn and wheat average 1 to 2% fat, 10% protein, and 75% carbohydrate. Acorn meal averages 21% fat, 5% protein, and 60% carbohydrate. Acorn meal was, of course, a staple food of the original human inhabitants of the area, though its use was abandoned by later people from cultures in which acorns were fed only to swine. The Kesh planted oaks in and around their towns and tended gathering trees in the woods and fields. The area was very rich in both species and numbers of oaks, and in a normal year there were vastly more acorns available than the human population could use. The Kesh favored the acorns from the valley oak and tan oak. Gathering and processing were a communal activity under the supervision of the Serpentine, though of course a family that wanted an extra supply could provide it for themselves. After sorting and hulling, the acorns were ground, the millers using special stones, acorn stones. Excess oil was saved for numerous uses. The meal, coarse or fine, was leached by submersion in cold or hot waters for a few hours up to several days, depending on the tannic acid content and the flavor desired. The meal or flour was usually parched or toasted before storage or just before use to sweeten and bring up the nutty flavor. Acorn meal soup, thick and variously flavored, was a daily winter food in many households. They called it domfas, brown soup. It was often an infant's first food other than breast milk. Coarser meal was boiled to make a porridge or batter, which was eaten like polenta or rice, or baked as a heavy, dry, rich bread. Acorn flour was combined with honey and toasted seeds and wheat flour and baked as sweet cakes and wafers. Being oily, the flavor of acorn meal deteriorated in storage, and generally what was left after half a year or so was shared out to animals. Teas, honey. The Kesh were fond of sweets, and there were sugar beet fields below Own Malin, but they found the cultivation and processing of that crop arduous, and most of their sweetening came from honey. Like game animals, bees were considered to be visitors from the sky houses who consented to come into the houses of the earth, and indeed to live in the small houses provided for them there. Most beekeepers were of the red adobe, and that house looked after the preparation, storage, and distribution of the honey. Bee towns, sets of hives, were numerous throughout the planting side of each human township. The hives were of wood, and the beekeepers used removable wooden frames for the honeycombs so that combs could be removed without destroying the hive or even dismaying the bees. Enough honey was made in the upper valley towns that it was used in trade with peoples to the north and east who were apparently less methodical in their bee husbandry. Fatfat, clown clown, a dessert. Clean about a quart of green gooseberries, red currants, or red huckleberries, with elder, madrone, or manzanita berries ad lib, any tart ripe berry, and stew gently. Stir up with honey to taste. Flavor with lemon rind or chopped kumquat if desired. Cool. Scald 1 to 2 pints very heavy cream and beat until cooled and thickened. Mix with the fruit. The scalded cream has a rich texture, very different from our fluffy whipped cream, but you have to start with a heavier cream than we are likely to have available. Lute, amoli. People in Shumo stewed amoli, or soap root, Chlorogallum pomeridianum, with a little honey, and ate it as a delicacy. People in the other 8 towns used it as shampoo. The Kesh version of De Gustibus Non Disputandem is he washes his hair with her dinner. Table manners. They set the table with plates, dishes, bowls, cups, drinking glasses, and so on, often beautiful and in considerable variety, but not in great profusion, since dishes, after all, have to be washed. For soups and sloppy dishes, they had spoons of china, wood, horn, and metal. Otherwise, they ate with their fingers. There was no taboo or sinister hand. It was presumed that you came to table with clean hands and you could eat right-handed, left-handed, or with both hands, neatly. The various kinds of bread served as containers, supporters, and soppers. Meat was sliced or cut before serving. Poultry was jointed. The table might be set bare or on a tablecloth or on mats of cloth or plaited reed, bamboo, cattail, or grass. There was a bowl or two of water to wash the fingers in, and often a large cloth napkin was passed around at the end of the meal. As the Kesh seldom used chairs, the tables were low. People sat on the floor with the legs straight out, curled to the side or crossed, tailor fashion, or they sat on a low chest bench that ran along two or three sides of most rooms and pulled a little stool table up before them to eat from. They counted three meals a day: breakfast, often of milk, bread, or mush, fresh or dry fruit, a lunch of leftovers or uncooked food, and dinner usually after sunset, hence early in winter and quite late in summer. They were, however, inclined to eat small amounts when hungry rather than to stuff in a great deal of food at a set time. This may be because food was both plentiful and handy, because no person was particularly privileged, obligated to prepare, dispense, or withhold food, and finally because heavy eating was considered embarrassing and gorging shameful. But greed could be satisfied more or less invisibly by casual but persistent snacking. As I remarked above, the Kesh were not a thin people.